Lecture 42, Lyndon Johnson, Professional Politician.
Welcome back. In the previous lecture, we carried the career of Lyndon Baines Johnson to the point at which he had been elected the youngest majority leader in the history of the United States Senate. In this lecture, we'll look at how he made the most of that opportunity. We'll examine the political positions he took as majority leader and his impact on the national government. We'll also study his election as vice president in 1960 and his assumption of the presidency itself upon the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. Despite the fears of some liberals, after assuming the presidency, Lyndon Johnson was absolutely determined to carry out the liberal legacy of his mentor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Ironically, Johnson's career as majority leader of the Senate did not begin positively. He suffered a heart attack in 1955, the same year in which he was elected majority leader. It was a serious medical condition. Doctors gave him only about an even chance of surviving, but he made a very quick comeback and some lifestyle adjustments. He quit smoking, he tried to watch his weight, and of course, he began resuming his absolutely impossible schedule. He would become the most effective Senate leader in U.S. history. He bent his will to uniting the normally fractious Democratic Party. Will Rogers, the great humorist, had once said, "I belong to no organized political party. I am a Democrat." So uniting Democrats was no mean feat. Lyndon Johnson mastered the details of policy and of Senate procedure. He built the alliances and gave out the political favors necessary to make things really happen in the Senate. He did what was necessary to bend individual senators to his will, including that famous Lyndon Johnson treatment. The treatment was an up-close and personal combination of argument, cajolery, threats, promises, and physical contact delivered unerringly at a single target. "Its velocity was breathtaking," wrote Evans and Novak, the journalists. "It ran the gamut of human emotions," they said, "and it was all in one direction. Interjections from the target were rare. Johnson anticipated them before they could be spoken. He moved in close, his face a scant millimeter from his target, his eyes widening and narrowing, his eyebrows rising and falling. From his pockets poured clippings, memos, statistics. Mimicry, humor, and the genius of analogy made the treatment an almost hypnotic experience and rendered the target stunned and helpless." That's what Evans and Novak had to say about this extraordinary Lyndon Johnson persuasive technique. American politics had never seen anything quite like the Lyndon Johnson treatment, and it would not again, at least to the present time, see that same kind of technique. Johnson even made a bid for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1956, running as a favorite son candidate from Texas. However, he provided little competition to Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson, who won the nomination, but then went on, of course, to lose to the incumbent president, Dwight Eisenhower. As Johnson's political power grew in the Senate, though, he set his sights much more seriously upon the ultimate goal of reaching the presidency. He began to abandon his promotion of regional conservative programs and instead began to embrace national liberal issues and to promote reform in cooperation with the Eisenhower administration. He was instrumental in winning an increase in the minimum wage, the admission of Hawaii to the Union, and the passage of the 1957 and 1960 Civil Rights Acts. Johnson investigated how the Russians beat the Americans into space. His efforts resulted in the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, and his efforts launched America's quest to try to outdo the Russians in space. This was truly a remarkable legacy for a senator whose party did not control the presidency at any time during his period as majority leader. You know, since Washington and Jefferson and Jackson, the great presidents we've studied, although some had tremendous careers, did not really have a major impact on the nation as a whole before being elected president of the United States. Lyndon Johnson certainly did have a major impact on the country in his role as majority leader before he became president as a result of the death of Kennedy, and of course later on he would be elected on his own. In 1960, this extraordinary political dynamo that was Lyndon Johnson tried once more, and this time seriously, to win the Democratic nomination for president. His campaign in 1960 began a history of dislike and antagonism between Johnson and John F. Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, who was serving as John's campaign manager. Johnson never really developed a personal dislike of John Kennedy, unlike Robert Kennedy, but he did feel some resentment of John Kennedy. He thought that as a senator, Kennedy was out grandstanding. Kennedy was out promoting himself. And who was staying back home in the Senate and doing all the work for the country? Of course, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Later, Johnson would recollect that Kennedy, quote, never said a word of importance in the Senate, and he never did a thing. But somehow, he managed to create the image of himself as a youthful leader who would change the face of the country. His growing hold on the American people was simply a mystery to me, unquote. And indeed, Johnson, drawing on his experience in the Senate, was running an insider's behind-the-scenes campaign while Kennedy was running the public campaign. Now, the insider's campaign certainly could work well for election as Senate Majority Leader, but it didn't work well in a quest for the presidency. Remember, Kennedy had been promoting himself for president in a very public way ever since his failed efforts to win the vice presidential nomination in 1956. Meanwhile, Johnson, of course, was working as an inside operator in the Senate, getting things done. In Johnson's words, quote, Jack was out kissing babies while I was passing bills, including his bills. I'm a doer. I've passed the bills. I've minded the store, unquote. Ironically, after the death of President Kennedy in 1963, it was Lyndon Johnson who would once again pass Kennedy's bills through Congress. In 1960, while Johnson, of course, was minding the store, Kennedy was out achieving the kind of public profile that could get you elected president of the United States. It's true. Lyndon Johnson really never did come to understand John Kennedy. Kennedy had that kind of glitzy, glamorous political style that was absolutely foreign to the down-to-earth Lyndon Johnson. At the Democratic Convention, Kennedy easily beat Johnson for the Democratic presidential nomination. As far as the vice presidency was concerned, Johnson, like Truman before him back in 1944, professed to have no interest in that job. Quote, I wouldn't want to trade a vote for a gavel, and I certainly wouldn't want to trade the active position of leadership of the greatest deliberative body in the world for the part-time job of presiding, unquote. However, there is evidence that Lyndon Johnson really was quite interested in assuming the vice presidency. He thought this would be a way of bringing the South into the mainstream of the Democratic Party. He also thought his days as an effective majority leader might be over. He thought that he might have a difficult time functioning whether Kennedy won or whether Nixon won in 1960. He was also well aware that about one quarter of previous vice presidents had gone on to assume the presidency. Those were the kinds of gambling odds worth taking. So Johnson did not really rule out the possibility of taking on the number two spot on the Kennedy ticket. As we saw in the previous lecture, over the objections of liberals, Kennedy did pick Johnson as his running mate, and the ticket went on to win the presidency. It went on to win Texas. It went on to win six other southern states as well. As the can-do political leader, Johnson decided that he wanted to make something out of nothing. He wanted to make something out of the vice presidency. Remember, John Adams had said of the vice presidency that it was the most insignificant office that ever the mind of man contrived. John Nance Garner, Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's first vice president, had said that it wasn't worth a warm bucket of spit. But Johnson wasn't having that. He wanted to make something out of this position. However, although Johnson maintained a civil relationship with President Kennedy, the two simply never became close. They never developed the kind of close relationship that could make the vice presidency a position of real influence and power. There were just too many differences in style, in temperament, and experience. All Johnson cared about was politics, and he was uncomfortable with the cultural and intellectual atmosphere of the Kennedy administration. At Kennedy's social functions, Johnson would often find himself alone and ignored. And remember, he had the ill will of Robert Kennedy, who was now Attorney General and who would ridicule Lyndon Johnson in private. Johnson's public profile, moreover, almost disappeared while he was vice president. A 1963 article in the Texas Observer magazine asked rhetorically, "What is an LBJ?" It had come to that for the once mighty leader of the Senate. Johnson was also stymied in his efforts to establish more formal power for the vice presidency. He wanted to continue presiding over Democratic caucuses in the Senate. He wasn't allowed to do that. He wanted to assume broad, formal executive authority as vice president. Of course, the president wasn't going to grant him that. Still, he was kept at least reasonably informed of important foreign and domestic policy matters and did hold some official positions. In particular, he served as chairman of the National Aeronautics and Space Council and of the President's Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity. Johnson's work on the Employment Opportunity Committee was important for deepening and strengthening his commitment to civil rights. He also traveled extensively on behalf of the White House, visiting dozens of countries and making many hundreds of speeches. He backed Kennedy's foreign and domestic policies, including the sending of military, quote-unquote, advisors to Vietnam. He supported the president's civil rights initiatives under the New Frontier. In an April 1961 memo on the space program, he also advocated the policy of going to the moon. This was before President Kennedy publicly came out with that program. Johnson wrote, quote, "Dramatic accomplishments in space are increasingly identified as a major indicator of world leadership. Manned exploration of the moon is not only an achievement with great propaganda value, but it is essential as an objective," unquote. An essential objective of going to the moon defined so early by the vice president. One of Johnson's most important trips was a mission to Vietnam. After that trip, Johnson reached the following conclusion, quote, "The fundamental decision required of the United States is whether we are to attempt to meet the challenge of communist expansion now in Southeast Asia by a major effort in support of the forces of freedom or throw in the towel," unquote. Ultimately, this extraordinary decision of what to do in Vietnam would fall upon Lyndon Johnson himself after the assassination of President Kennedy. In some ways, Johnson was one of the most influential and active vice presidents to that point in history. At least he had some kind of a substantive role in the administration. But of course, it was far too little for a man of Johnson's towering ambition and towering ego. He chafed under the vice presidency. He would never complain publicly. He would never criticize President Kennedy publicly. But clearly he was unhappy. He was restless as vice president. Later he would confide to biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin the following. "The vice presidency is filled with trips around the world, chauffeurs, men saluting, people clapping, chairmanships of councils. But in the end, it is nothing. I despised every minute of it." That might be something of an exaggeration, but it does show just how restless and unhappy he was as being the number two guy. But as you know, of course, Johnson did not endure the vice presidency for a full term. On November 22, 1963, Vice President Johnson was riding in a motorcade in Dallas, two cars behind President Kennedy, when an assassin's bullet fatally wounded America's youngest elected president. Johnson then became president that day as he flew back to Washington, D.C. Shortly thereafter, he appointed a commission directed by Chief Justice Earl Warren to investigate the assassination of the president. As we indicated in the previous lecture, the commission reported later its conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the lone assassin. Johnson himself apparently did not really accept this conclusion. He seemed to believe that there may well have been a conspiracy, most likely organized by pro-Castro Cubans, but he did not in public, of course, challenge the findings of his own commission. In putting together the Warren Commission, Lyndon Johnson showed that he could still apply the famous Johnson treatment and that he could even apply it over the telephone. Here's part of a recorded phone conversation with Senator Richard Russell. This is part of what he said to Senator Russell in trying to persuade this very reluctant senator to serve on the Warren Commission. Quote, "This is not me. This is your country. Don't tell me what you can do and what you can't, because I can't arrest you, and I'm not going to put the FBI on you, but you're goddamn going to serve." A little bit of threat, a little bit of cajolery, a little bit of appeal to Senator Russell's patriotism. You're not serving me here, you're serving your country. Liberals, of course, feared that the new president, this president from the Deep South, the first one, might lead the country in a more conservative direction. Their fears were absolutely unfounded. Johnson had been steering a more liberal course ever since he had set his sights on the White House back in the mid-1950s. And, of course, he had grown up with Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. Just after JFK's assassination, Johnson would confide the following to Kennedy's top economic advisor, Walter Heller. Quote, "Now, I want to say something about all this talk that I'm a conservative who is likely to go back to the Eisenhower ways. It's not so. If you look at my record, you would know that I am a Roosevelt New Dealer. As a matter of fact, to tell the truth, John F. Kennedy was a little too conservative to suit my taste, unquote. As compared to the cultured sophistication of the Kennedy administration, Johnson did bring, shall we say, a raw earthiness to the White House. In style, he could not have been more different. Indeed, his antics exceeded even those of Teddy Roosevelt. Johnson would have aides follow him into the bathroom, where they would continue conversations that they had begun in the office. He would lead visitors to the White House pool, where he would strip down and jump in and expect others to do the same. At one point on national television, he raised his shirt to show on his abdomen a scar from a recent operation. He even outraged some dog lovers when he picked up his beagles by their ears. On his ranch, he would drive visitors around on his own, driving at breakneck speed across dirt roads, sipping scotch from a paper cup. When he finished a drink, he is said to have held out his hand and have the Secret Service slip him a refill. But there was much more. Johnson also brought to the presidency the greatest legislative operation in the history of the office. No president had spent as much time as Lyndon Johnson at getting legislation through Congress. No president paid as much attention as Lyndon Johnson to the legislative process. No president knew the process better than Lyndon Johnson. And of course, no president knew the members of Congress better than Lyndon Johnson. At one point, Johnson is said to have exclaimed, "I know those senators from eyeball to ankle." Actually, Johnson used a much earthier A word than ankle, but we are not going to repeat that word here. With the power of the presidency behind it, of course, Johnson's famous treatment was more effective than ever before. And of course, now he had plenty to trade in return for votes in Congress. Johnson would also establish as president his famous double days. He would have one day from early in the morning until about mid-afternoon, and then he would have another day starting at about 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and he would go on sometimes until after midnight. It was amazing. But Johnson's immediate objective as president, of course, was to convince the American people that there would be continuity in the leadership of the country. He had to assure the American people that the leadership of the White House was in safe hands. In a televised address on November 27, 1963, he declared, quote, "Today, in this moment of new resolve, I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue," unquote. And continue he would. His goal was to get congressional action on stalled Kennedy measures. And of course, he was aided in this not only by his own consummate legislative skills, but also by the fact that he was now trying to put into effect the ideas of the martyred young president. His two top priorities were the stalled tax cut and the stalled civil rights law. A week after his televised address, in a behind-the-scenes meeting with congressional leaders, Johnson urged them to, quote, "get the tax bill reported in the Senate, and then when we finish taxes, we'll have civil rights over there," unquote. Very quickly, Johnson would, in fact, realize these initiatives and then supplement them with a quote-unquote war on poverty of his own design, although built on initiatives begun under Kennedy. Remember, Johnson had to be the biggest, the best, the most colossal, the most successful. And that was how he approached his accidental presidency. He wanted to steer through Congress the greatest harvest of domestic legislation in the history of the country. He wanted to equal, maybe even surpass, the great Franklin Roosevelt. And in just 1 year, Johnson was well on his way to achieving this goal. True to his word, Johnson did deal quickly with the tax cut, which Congress passed early in 1964. Johnson personally lobbied every single member of the Senate Finance Committee to get the tax cut through. But Johnson's greatest legislative triumph, and indeed one of the greatest legislative triumphs in the history of the presidency, was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This was the first truly effective major civil rights bill since the era of Reconstruction. It would mark the end of the dual society, one white and one black, that still had legal sanction in much of the American South. It was a comprehensive piece of legislation. It prohibited employment discrimination on the basis of race, religion, sex, or national origin. It set up an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It outlawed discrimination in public accommodations, such as restaurants and hotels. It outlawed segregation in public facilities, such as municipal beaches, hospitals, and parks. It included provisions to hasten the desegregation of schools and promote fair voting practices. To help ensure compliance, the bill gave the Attorney General injunctive powers to initiate desegregation suits. It gave the government power to withhold funds from institutions not in compliance with the law. It was an incredible, extraordinary piece of legislation. The law was a landmark for women as well as for racial minorities, because Title VII, the title on employment discrimination, also prohibited for the first time discrimination based upon sex. Ironically, though, it was not liberals and progressives who actually put this provision with regard to gender discrimination into the Civil Rights Act. It was put into the act by Southern segregationists who thought that by adding sex discrimination, they would make the act so unacceptable given the standards of the time that it would be defeated. But women members of Congress seized the opportunity to make sex discrimination an integral part of the law, and some somewhat reluctant male reformers went along. This was landmark legislation, which following upon the Equal Pay Act of 1963, which we had talked about in the previous lecture, was very important in helping to spark the rise of a women's movement in the United States in the mid and late 1960s. And as we described in the previous lecture, other important initiatives with regard to sex discrimination would follow the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The critical vote on the passage of this bill actually came on a vote to end a filibuster in the Senate by invoking cloture, which, remember, that's ending debate, in those days required 67 votes, not 60, two-thirds of the Senate. Never before had cloture been successfully invoked to break a filibuster on civil rights. So this vote was a real showdown. Cloture had the support of both the Republican and Democratic leadership, but the vote count appeared to be exceedingly close. It was so close that Senator Claire Engel of California, who had a brain tumor and could not speak, had himself pushed into the Senate chamber on a wheelchair. When the time came for the vote, he simply pointed to his eye to cast his vote in favor of cloture. Ultimately, it did prove to be a bit of an anticlimax, as cloture was invoked by an overwhelming margin and the path was cleared for the Civil Rights Act. Johnson would also use the power of the presidency to advance civil rights and women's rights. By executive order, he would begin affirmative action programs for women and minorities. After being elected on his own in 1964. He would also steer through Congress the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. In our next lecture, we'll look at that landslide Lyndon Johnson win in 1964 and his term as president in his own right.